Today we're focusing on relieving suffering, and our text comes from Mark chapter 3. And Carrie, in very few words, said it well. She said, boy, you couldn't have a better topic this week. And so let us go to God with our sense of the struggles that we face and that others face, and look at Jesus' encounter with this particular man in Mark chapter 3. Again, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched Jesus to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. And Jesus said to the man who had the withered hand, come forward. And he said to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? But they were silent. He looked around at them with anger, and he was grieved at their hardness of heart. And he said to them, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. It's an interesting situation that Jesus finds himself in. In the legal mind of the Jewish tradition of his day, they had it so that you never had to think about anything, because there was a rule for everything. If you wanted to know exactly what you needed to do, there was a rule for it. And so when he asked them, is it against the law, is it against the rules for me to do this work, to heal this man on the Sabbath, the answer was yes. It was against the rule. But what were the rules for, if not to make that person better? I am pretty sure that when Kayla gets home, they're coming home, she's on fall break, and she'll be home this afternoon. I'm pretty sure that there's going to be a push for me to take her to South Carolina, because Kayla started going on youth mission trips when she was one. She was just that baby. We had to hold her like 6 hours a day. Abby was never like that. We, you know, she was just always going until she would just kind of pass out at the end of the day, and then you put her in the bed. So Kayla, we started taking when she was at age one, and we took her on a mission trip, and I had to put her in the church van at midnight to drive her around so she'd go to sleep. And then through the years, we ended up going to different places, and I took her down to Katrina, and I'd already been down to Mississippi to sort of scout out the site. And I took a group of about 15, 18 so folks, and we drove into the Presbyterian Disaster Assistance site, and they had these tents set up in this church piece of property. And there were the showers there, which were like trash bag showers, and so, you know, they were all kind of there, and then they had those little porta-potty things that they brought in. And I drove in with my group, and I had Kayla and her best friend, who were 12. Now, Kayla, by age 12, had been on at least 10, 11 mission trips. Her friend had been, you know, with us some, and she was like a daughter to me. Grew up to be the band director for their marching band, so it was very special. And a 15-year-old had been on several mission trips, and then probably 15 adults. And so I pull in, and the head of the PDA site said, you can't stay. I said, what do you mean I can't stay? We're down here to do relief. I've already met people. I know what we're going to do. I know the skills of the people I've got. He said, well, it's against the rules. You have to be at least 18. I said, you understand this is a hurricane, right? He said, yeah. And I said, and you understand water has come all the way to here, and part of this church got flooded. He said, yeah. There are no hotels. There's no place for me to go with my daughter and friend and my children here. Yeah, I'm sorry, but that's against the rule. So I walked over and saw somebody who was a member of the church, and I said, hey, you know, all the church didn't get flooded. The fellowship hall didn't get flooded, right? They said, yes. Can we stay in the fellowship hall? They said, yeah. So we stayed in the fellowship hall right there by all the tents, and it was air conditioned. So it worked out well for us. The guy's main complaint was that because of these showers that they would blow open, and I tried to explain to him the difference between good naked and bad naked, and I promised nobody was going to look. But he understood what the rules were. And you have to have rules, and rules are good. There were rules here in this situation, but Jesus said, what are the rules about? What are they for? Do you see this man who's here? I brought an object lesson for this week. It's a book. It's titled The Healing Dialogue in Psychotherapy by Maurice Friedman. And I thought it offered some good stuff for this week's sermon. If only I'd read it. It got here like Wednesday, and I've been busy. And I just figured it was better than the object lesson I used last week, which was my belt. So I thought I would hold this up to say, I know what this book is about. And this book is centered from the work of Maurice Friedman, who was a scholar of Martin Buber. And Martin Buber said that there are basically three types of relationships. And one of the lowest level of relationships is I-it, which is how you relate to an object. And we can have really close relationships to objects. There's an object that you love. I'm sure the guitars and the bass that are up here, they're very personal objects and they're very important objects. There are objects that we love. Some people, it's this. I can tell you that this new generation who walk around texting, they have peripheral vision like nothing you've ever seen. And if you go to the football game, what you'll notice is that there are a whole bunch of people walking like this, but they don't run into each other. It's an amazing thing. But this is an object. We've been studying the story of the Garden of Eden on Wednesday night, and there is a version that I think probably has some merit that when Eve is walking through the garden and there in the tree, the serpent whispers and goes, "Psst, hey, Eve, come here. I got something I want to show you. It's this Apple computer." And she gets there and she's, you know, blogging and Facebooking and doing all that. And Adam comes up, "Hey, what you doing?" She says, "Nothing, leave me alone." And the next thing you know, he's got an Apple iPhone, and then it's just all mess from there. Buber says, yes, you can relate to objects, and relating to objects is good. But the problem is when we relate to people as if they are an object, which is part of the problem of what goes on in Eden. That's when the first theology begins, and the serpent convinces them to talk about God as if God were an object. God's not there. They talk about God in third person. Well, what about God? God's just looking out for himself. God has his own objects. You should want that thing. It's a piece of fruit. How many pieces of fruit do you need when you're living in the garden? But apparently this one was what you had to have. That's relating to an object. What's really dangerous is when we objectify people. I did a book, which you're welcome, and if you like it and you want to share it with people, I got more coming, that's great. But there are, you know, words that can be helpful. I want to do one on dirty words. And one of the dirty words, I think, is the word they. Anytime you talk about a group of people as if you understand the whole or the person by the many, the word they is very dangerous. Anytime somebody says, well, Americans think, well, Americans don't all think the same thing. People say, what do people at Macklin believe? And I was like, what do you mean people? They believe different things. They think different things. Be careful with the word they. My mother, being from the South, had this thing about Yankees, and I married a girl from Michigan. And so she would say things about Yankees, but not you, Carrie, you're a good one. She had that true with people of color. You know, she would make statements, but not that one, that's a good one. See, that's the word they. Is anytime you group a group of people, you don't see the person. In this story, the people, in the religious people, they're not seeing the person. And that's the problem. If you're going to live out this mission statement to go and reach the lost, you've got to go get lost. Lost people don't come into the church and say, hey, I'm lost. No, you've got to go where lost people go. And you've got to get lost in order to help somebody. There's a great story shared for a lot of different groups about a guy who falls in a hole. And he's yelling out, help. And a guy comes along and says, hey, I'll help you. And then he falls in the hole. And down in the bottom of the hole, the guy says, I thought you were going to help me. He said, I am. Well, then why didn't you stay up there? He said, because I've fallen in this hole 4 or 5 times. I know how to get out. That's how you help people. Lost people are great at helping people who are lost. So you got to go out. But you got to make that personal connection. It has to be about person. Yesterday at Penny's funeral, a guy stood up. His name's Steve Price. And Steve and I worked together in Clemson for 5 years. And Steve stood up And he told them about working with Penny. He told them about when his sister committed suicide and how they pounded on the door and wouldn't let him stay in that dark place. They crossed the distance. He was lost and they found him. But Penny is that person who wouldn't open that door. Steve also stood in front of that crowd and said that he's gay. Now, I worked with Steve for 5 years. Along that way, I knew Steve was gay, but we didn't talk about it because we couldn't. Because it was important for me as another staff member not to know that, so that I didn't talk about it. And that's tragic. And so I went up to Steve and said, "Steve, I need to tell you, I'm sorry. But I just need you to know, I've grown up since then. And I can deal with persons. And so if you ever ask me what I think about they, I'm going to ask, who are you talking about? Because I wasn't able to help my friend Steve. Not that he asked me for that help, but I just didn't know how. Because I didn't know how to deal with persons. Because we were so busy caught up with talking about they and not being able to make that personal connection. And when you talk about they, people become an object. They don't become persons. So when you're going to raise disciples, now that sounds like as if you have it all together, but disciples is different than Christian. Christian's like when you became one. Did you become a Christian? Yes, I'm a Christian. Oh, great, it's all settled. Anybody who's been married or is married, you understand that you didn't just get married. It began then. You don't grow up and get married. You get married and hope to God that somehow you grow up. I'm still working on it, as Carrie would tell you. She's gone this weekend. With Kayla's break, they're up in Nashville. So I'm going to have to go home and wash me some dishes before she gets home. But that's the thing is, disciple means I'm still learning. I'm following along the way. That's why Jesus said, look, if you want to learn from me, he didn't tell people to go to the great scholars. He said, go look at some children because they understand they don't get it. It's adults who think they figured it all out. You're going to teach? You'll learn more by teaching than you will by just being a student. So you need to understand as a teacher, you're the chief student. And you got to pay attention to your crowd because they'll tell you. That's how you learn. So if somebody tells you they got all the answers, they don't even have the right questions. And if you're going to relieve suffering, you've got to be able to make that connection. Richard summed up Penny yesterday. He said, okay, you Presbyterians, here's the deal. Penny would tell you, you got to quit squabbling. You're arguing about silly stuff. You got to love others and inspire love. And if you do that, then you can figure out the rest. Hard to beat that. Roger Nishioka taught youth over here at the seminary for a while, and Roger shared this story, and I think it's a great story that kind of sums up the church. This was while he was in Louisville. He was working as a youth leader at a church in Louisville. And Roger, while he was there, there was a young fellow named Scotty that moved in. And the way I tell the story, it was New Jersey, but the last time I heard him, it was somebody where else, but I can't remember where it was, so for the sake of the story, okay, he moved from elsewhere. And Scotty had friends there, he had a life there, he was on the basketball team, and he was not happy about moving there. And so Scotty's mom said, hey, I want you to help my son because he's not getting connected. So when Roger was sitting around at the session meeting, Janet Simmons was there, and Janet Simmons would knit during the session meetings. And so she was sitting there knitting. And the reason she knitted during the session meeting is so that when the meeting was over, she could hold up whatever she'd done and say, look, something tangible was done for the kingdom of God today. I'm just saying. So she said, and apparently the kid's name was actually Scott, and she said, so Roger, you know, had told her about the kid, and then during Sunday, she said, Roger, which is the kid you want me to watch out for? Well, he was easy to find, because he came in, they sat on the back row, and as soon as that last hymn was over in the benediction, he was out. Well, when he went running out the church that day, Janet was waiting on him. And she said, Scotty, which is probably uncool to call him Scotty. She said, Scotty, my name is Janet, and I'm going to hug you. And I want you to know that I love you and I'm praying for you. And that was it. She hugged him and loved him and prayed. He was gone. Every Sunday, she was there. And she was waiting on him. And she would hug him and tell him, Scotty, I love you and I'm praying for you. And he would go. One day, he got out before she found him. She went out to the car, got him before they drove away, knocked on the window, said, Scotty, you got to get out of the car because I haven't hugged you yet. Got out of the car. Scotty, I love you and I'm praying for you. And then Scotty went away. Well, Scotty began to watch for her, kind of like a rabbit looks for a dog, you know, kind of, or whatever, hunts rabbits. And so he would watch for her, and one day she wasn't there. Because he would look for her when she came into the church, just so he know you want to keep that kind of thing in front of you. They announced that during the service, and when they did Joys and Concerns, that Janet was in the hospital. And they were having some tests run. After church is over, they get in the car, and Scott says, Mom, can we go by that, you know, where the hospital where that crazy lady is? And she said, yeah, no, it's not anywhere near where we're going. It's not on the way home. He said, no, Mom, can we go by there? And she said, okay. So he's headed down the hallway in the hospital, going toward the room. She's almost having to run to keep up with him. He goes in the room, climbs up into bed with her, and said, Miss Simmons, what's going on? How you doing? And she said, well, Scotty, I haven't been in the hospital since I had my babies. And I got to tell you, I'm pretty scared. And he said, well, I just want you to know, I love you and I'm praying for you. And then he got out of the bed, looked at his mom, and said, okay, we can go. And she said, well, Scott, I want to talk to her for a while. He said, okay, I'll wait for you in the car. And he left. And when she came in the church with a walker, guess who was waiting for her? It's just that simple. Now let's talk about it on a bigger scale. See, I've been losing sleep all week because I've been watching this hurricane. And I want to encourage you a couple things. Be careful how you use the word blessing. I get really scared when God says, you know, people say to me, have a blessed day. I got my hair cut in Nashville. God said, have a blessed day. Have a blessed weekend. See, the problem is, what I consider to be a blessing and what God considers to be a blessing, they're not the same thing. If you read in the Gospel of Matthew, it's very nice. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That's sweet. In Luke, blessed are the poor and cursed are the rich. I would rather have the cursed part. You know, just saying. So the guy tells me, have a blessed weekend. Over that weekend, the church flooded, and so did most of Nashville, and I blame it on the guy who cut my hair. Be careful, because what God considers to be a blessing and what you consider to be a blessing, they're not the same thing. And when people tell me they're praying for me, sometimes I don't want God's attention. So I have this relationship with God where I'm watching that hurricane, and now I have this connection to Haiti. I really didn't want a connection to Haiti, but a guy in my church in Orlando has this phenomenal mission where he went down after the earthquake. He was doing Clean the World, which is they were taking soap from hotels, which there are more than four in Orlando, and they were melting the soap down with homeless people and then sending it to Haiti because the killer's germs, things we take for granted. Well, after the earthquake, he goes down, and he's the kind of guy who, well, the planes are having a problem. He walks down the tarmac, starts directing all these planes, and tells them where to go. That's just the kind of guy he is. So I meet up with him, and I think this guy's the real deal. He gets stuff done. So I go to Haiti. We end up la, 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 and then now I'm watching the Weather Channel, praying that that little red circle doesn't go anywhere, or at least doesn't cover the area where I now feel responsible for five children's homes. Now, I'm not telling you should do this, but just God told me one night, he said, you know, the words, let my people go. Because see, we read Exodus and go, oh, the slaves, they got free. There's still people, slaves all over the place. There are people who are slave to poverty here. And poverty is just a lack of choices. And I will tell you that if that hurricane had come into the eye, I mean, I was on the coast of South Carolina when Hugo hit, and I've seen what a hurricane can do. For the Francis Marion Forest whacked down those trees like it was a lawnmower. But America has the infrastructure and the information so that what's happening in Haiti is exponentially worse. And I'm not saying that's your problem. I'm just saying it's my problem because God told me so. Now, there are missions that are around here that I just want to encourage you to ask God. And when you pray, don't pray for people in Haiti. Say, God, what do you want me to do? If you give a dollar, well, it's like three bottles of water. I think they would rather have the three bottles of water right now. What do you want me to do? But be really careful, because God may answer you. Poverty is a lack of choices. Not a lack of money. It's a lack of choices. And you have choices. If you're here, if you're in this country, the infrastructure here is amazing. The ability to remove debris after a hurricane is phenomenal. It's not like that in Haiti. Kayla went down there and she said, the biggest problem is infrastructure. And I went, it took me 3 weeks to figure that out. And she figured it out in a day. She's got it going on. Abby saw a group that was going around and they were taking pictures of things they weren't involved in, like pumping a well that they didn't build and doing those things. And Abby, is this like a poverty safari? She's got it going on. Boy right here said, Dad, we're going to adopt a kid. I said, really? He said, yeah. In fact, if you're not got two tickets coming back when we go to Haiti, you better make mine one way. Problem is, though, which one, right? But that's our thing. That doesn't mean it's your thing. I just want to tell you that charity, though, is the big killer of mission. Charity is kind of like that inoculation where you do a little bit and then you don't get caught up in the disease of it. But real mission is like crack. Once you get hooked, once you actually get things done. I was in touch with Nikki, our presbytery exec, and it dawned on me, because of my experience with other presbyteries, I shouldn't take that bias with this presbytery and say them. So I was in touch with her. I said, I got a church off the coast of Haiti that it's where people need to go. They don't have houses, but they're looking to their church. And it's a room like our size of our narthex, probably has about 100 people on Sundays. And I told Nikki, I said, you know, it's not a Presbyterian church, but for $7,000, it could have a Presbyterian roof. But that's my thing. And if we're going to grow in mission, it can't be because it's our pastor does that. No, That's between you and God. You're not getting off that easy. I'm not the filter that keeps you from having to say, okay, God, what do you want me to do? You are to be that person. And see, that's how you go from beyond a relationship with stuff to having a relationship with people. And what Buber said is, when you actually encounter a person, there's something alive between a real encounter. And you know what that feels like. When you actually have a connection with a person, and if you're going to have a connection with God, God's not going to be asking you about your dreams. God's going to tell you about God's dreams. I was not very happy when the hurricane come plowing through Haiti, and I told God that. But now I know what God's not happy about with Haiti. Let my people go. And if you connect with the thou, Martin Buber used capital letters, you're going to know God's dreams for the world. When we pray thy kingdom come, we don't mean my kingdom come, we mean your kingdom come. And you've got to be connected to God so that God helps you see what your job is in the greater narrative of God's story. And believe me, it will haunt you, so be very careful. And if you want to get up after I say amen and run away, I'll understand. Because what we're talking about when we say faith is the courage to be able to say, okay, God, what do you want? I've been saving this story, but you mentioned like the debates and all the other stuff that's going on. I'm going to use it now because it's a good one. The best sermon, I think, in the United States was Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. And since we are in Atlanta area where Martin Luther came from, in the text of what he wrote down for that speech, the I Have a Dream part is not there. Mahalia Jackson was sitting there after she had sung a song, and she's sitting there, I think, off to his left. And while he's preaching that sermon, she says this: "Tell them about the dream, Martin." And he kicks. It's not my job to tell you the dream. It's my job to be Mahalia Jackson and say, "People, tell them about the dream." Because what you're hearing on TV, what you're hearing from others, it ain't the dream. It's not God's dream for the world. God's dream for the world is that nobody goes through a hurricane and has their life blown, destroyed. Nobody lives in water that's polluted from the waste of others. That's just not the way it should be. Morality, very simple in Haiti. No clean water, you ought to have clean water. It's just that simple. So my job is to not be Martin Luther King and give you the dream. My job is to tell you, tell them about the dream. That's your job. Let us pray. God, our dreams, well, they stink. So give us your dreams. Keep us up at night with a vision for the world of how it could be. And help us to be the church, because the government's not going to do it for us. Nobody else is going to do it for us, so it's time the church started being the church, and that we started being disciples, following after your dreams for the world. For it is, after all, your place, not ours. That's why we've come. That's why we've gathered, and with a little bit of fear and trembling, that's why we lift our voices, praying as we were taught, saying, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. And give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen."